Welcome to this fourth edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on Metaphors for Life, a continuation of chapter one, which was titled The Eschatological Outlook, Think Like God. In this continuation of the chapter, we will examine several metaphors for life so we can get a better understanding of what life is about. The cosmos isn't the only thing we have to deal with in this life. We also have to deal with this mortal realm. And now, these thoughts on what mortal life is. This isn't so much an eschatological outlook as it is a set of tools for getting our heads screwed on straight as we contemplate the complexities of life. I feel it belongs in this chapter, though. Knowing how to look at life is an important tool as we contemplate our place in the cosmos, and ultimately it's all part of one whole. There is no separation between this life and our eternal lives any more than there is between going to fifth grade and the rest of our mortal lives. So any eschatological outlook that deals with any one aspect of our eternal lives will be part of the whole. Life is like a flight simulator. I've heard, I've never seen, that they have flight simulators hooked up to computers and screens that make it seem like you're actually flying an airplane. I guess that's what the 9/11 terrorists trained on. If you push the controls wrong, you crash into the ground. Now imagine someone taking at a flight school 20 sessions of flight simulator and each time deliberately crashing the plane. When they get out of school, their chances of finding employment at an airline are nil, I would imagine. And yet, they've hurt no one, killed no one, destroyed no equipment. Now let us put that on the back burner for the moment and consider our mortal lives. Consider someone to whom the worst atrocities have been committed. An innocent child, perhaps, who has been kidnapped, tortured, and murdered. All of these things were done to the mortal or temporal body of this child, not to their immortal, eternal spirit. The only harm actually done was to the physical. It is impossible to harm the spirit without the spirit's willing cooperation. Just like the flight simulator, there was much crashing and destruction, but in the end, as the student walks away from the simulator unharmed, so we, as we go back to God, walk away from the disasters of life unharmed. Okay, now a long digression, then back to the above. I wrestle with this problem and can't come up with a solution that rests easy in my soul, especially as it deals with the Jews and the Holocaust, which, as I figure, if you can say, well, that's as it should be then, no permanent harm done, then you can say that about virtually any human disaster. I'm waging a battle here between trying to get an honest, rational look at the horrors of life in their worst form, putting them into an eternal, eschatological context, and yet not coming off as uncaring, cavalier, unsympathetic. Later in this work, I say, lastly, nothing I'm going to say here will sum up, oh, well, then, the Holocaust was no big deal and everything is all right. That most certainly is not my intent. But I do believe everything must eventually be examined in the light of the eschatological outlook. But if I maintain, as I started out above, that there is no harm to the spirit, only the temporal body, which is, temporary, then someone who has had such evils as described done to a child will hold me in contempt, and understandably so. I've never had any such crimes done to my children or grandchildren, nor to myself. Yes, I have no grounds for true empathy or understanding. There is no level playing field here between me and victims. I fully acknowledge that. Everything I write here is academic, as it were, not feelings and thoughts from actual experience, thank God. In other words, this struggle is between eternal realities and temporal feelings, which must be respected and dealt with through compassion and gentleness. We can't just say to someone who has lost a child, as per above, "Hey, no big deal. It'll come out okay in the long run. Chill out." That would be hurtful and unfeeling in the worst extreme. And yet, technically, that is true. And yet, from our current feelings in such a situation to our development of a true and eternal eschatological outlook is a bridge we must all cross. And I'm not sure what that bridge is. Time? Patience? Help, nurture, and guidance from the Spirit of God? Understanding and counsel from others who have been through the same? All of the above and more? I don't want to be cold, unfeeling, callous, or cavalier. I am torn with this dichotomy. How to get there from here? And as I say, this isn't my specific personal problem, but others do have this problem to deal with. And how do I proceed without stepping on their toes? No clear answers yet. But at the very least, I want those in these situations to at least know I'm wrestling with it and am trying very hard not to be a jerk with their sincere and very legitimate feelings. And now as I read and edit this, I realize that God Himself, living in the midst of and the very definition of eschatology, doesn't take a cold-blooded attitude toward these events. When something happens to a child, as I've described, I'm sure he's outraged. Remember in the New Testament, he says, anybody who offends one of these little ones, it'd be better for him to have a millstone tied around his neck and be dropped into the sea. So that definitely shows some passion on the part of God in dealing with these issues. I'm sure he's outraged. So God lives in two worlds. The world of our legitimate and righteous emotions, and the world of the cosmos, in which everything works out for the best. It would seem. Maybe I'm off base here. Maybe I need to give more respect and credence to the emotions engendered by such events. Yes, God is outraged, angered, frustrated, disappointed, sorrowful when these atrocities occur. He doesn't just say, "Hey, suck it up," in the eternal context of things. It's no big deal. I think this is a reflection of the male and female principles operating in all of us. We are, every one of us, a combination of our mothers and fathers. So is God. The female principle is, among other things, emotional. When these tragedies occur, it is the female principle that responds emotionally. And it is correct. These events do require emotional processing, a factoring in of feelings that set them in a proper context to the cosmos. Now, this is not to say that males don't have feelings in these situations as well. I'm sure they do. I know I would. And they are just as legitimate as the emotions of the females involved. If God Himself has these emotions from His feminine side, and I believe He does, then it must be right, for He is the definition of right. And remember, He created us in His image and likeness. Eventually, since we can't be emotional eternally, the rational male side has to kick in, bring things back to an even keel, and get on with our eternal lives. Since to be one with ourselves, we have to give play and place to both our feminine and masculine aspects, then such events as I have described need to be dealt with both parts of our eternal makeup. If we can't give play and place to both parts of our being, then we're incomplete and need to find ways to bring out both. Males need to let their emotions have legitimate expression when these events occur. Females need to eventually let go of their feelings at least a bit and try and bring life back to a normality that augurs for continued spiritual progress. This is why God put male and female together and called them one. They were incomplete until that happened. We men need our wives' emotional feeling and input on events. They need our ultimate rational and steadying approach. Now, for a while, I was a director at the Phoenix Library books for the blind, recorded books for the blind, and I participated with my narrator partner in recording several books for the blind. The most memorable book we recorded was one called Bearing the Unbearable, by an Arizona State University therapist and grief counselor, Professor Susan Cacciatore. She lost a baby and has the experience and schooling to counsel those who are grieving over the loss of loved ones. As to how this fits with the above, she says that people who say, get over it, move on, are worse than hurtful, even though they may mean well. Grief and grieving is a part of life, just as thorns are part of the rose. They are natural, normal, and we have to let them into our lives so we learn how to cope with them and still function at least somewhat. Some people, when they've lost a close beloved, commit suicide. I'll deal with that later, but to my way of thinking, a suicide means you've killed your loved one a second time. For how will they live in mortality if not in your memory? Grief has to be patiently borne and worked with to bring things back to a workable life for the victim. You will never forget them, nor should you. But you have to find ways to live with your sorrow as well, or you and the memory of your loved one die too. Now, for anyone reading this or hearing this who has lost a loved one and is grieving, I strongly, heartily recommend this book, Dr. Susan Cacciatore, Cacciatore, and the book is called Bearing the Unbearable. It's available on Amazon. Okay, back to the original thoughts. Life is a flight simulator. Okay, we got that. Life is a rose. Life is a play. Life is an audition. Life is yin and yang. Life is prickles and goo. Life is baby and bathwater. Life is a school classroom. Life is a 10,000-piece puzzle. Now, note in all this, I haven't said life is good and evil, and there is that too. I have a whole chapter on evil later on in this work. It's just that I think there are other ways of looking at life that will help us get our heads screwed on straight, and the above metaphors are what I've come up with so far. There's more to life than good and evil. There's also great for me and damn nuisance. Now, to elaborate on each. As to a play, that's much like the flight simulator analogy. Consider a play, even Shakespearean, where at the end the stage is full of murder victims and women who have been assaulted. Some of his stuff is pretty bloody, but when the curtain rings down, the actors get up and walk away. No harm done. I think it's the same thing with our mortal lives. When we die, we basically get up and walk away. Now, our body, of course, goes into the grave or the crematorium, whatever the case may be, but the eternal, personal, potential thought or action or whatever that is us gets up and walks away and continues our stream of life. It may take a bit of time for emotions and passions to cool down and level off, just as it may take a bit for the actors to come back to real life. I read in near-death experiences that when we pass through that tunnel of light, there are friends, family, and relatives who have gone on who welcome us home. I think the overwhelming and instantaneous knowledge that our death hasn't ended our existence, and that now we're home and in loving, helpful company, does much to alleviate whatever pain, fright, and suffering we might have gone through prior to our death. I'm sure this is especially true for innocent children who have suffered horrible and frightening things. Again, this is not to say such stuff is therefore okay. But I also don't think, in the overall context of our eternal life, that it is as bad and permanently scarring as we might think it is. Maybe that's one of the great aspects of this mortal life. Everyone gets to work out whatever evils and weaknesses are in their souls in a milieu that doesn't do any real or permanent, that is, eternal, lasting harm, at least to the victims. An evil person may cut off your arm or blind your eyes, but are you going to go through the rest of eternity without an arm or blind? Of course not. It's only temporary until you die. The perpetrators, well, that's another story. These things have to be established and proven here for each person's character. So when they come into a realm where their evil actions would have real and eternal consequences, they won't be in any kind of position to carry them out. Flight simulator again. This also serves as a definition of reality. I've done a couple dinner theater type plays, and there are basically two realities. Number one is the world the actors are trying to create with the audience. Number two is the real world after the curtain falls and they go home to their families and day jobs. Both are real. An actor must never break character and ruin the flow of the play. Can you imagine someone in the middle of, say, Hamlet's soliloquy, excusing himself for a moment with the audience because his cell phone rang and he has to answer it? It would be a cold day in hell before he got another part. Same with this earth life. We can't take a momentary break from the action. The play must go on until we've spoken our last lines. We have to live and function with this temporary reality, the shadow world of Plato's cave, until we're done. Then we go back to the more permanent, real, and overarching reality of existence in the cosmos. Life is, therefore, two realities, and we have to deal with both. We can't ignore one or the other. Balance. This, as I mentioned earlier, will be a used-up theme as we go also. Another play metaphor for life is this. Imagine you're a theater critic for a major newspaper. You're assigned to view and evaluate this popular new three-act play at the local theater. Due to traffic and other problems, you miss the first act. Then, about midway through the second act, you are called out on an emergency. You miss the rest of that act, plus all of the third. But you are still required to write a review of the entire play. Impossible, of course, to write any kind of insightful and accurate review. Thus it is with our lives. We don't remember our premortal life or the first act in our three-act play. We participate in only a small part of the second act, the totality of mortal life, and we have no idea of the third act, where all loose ends are tied up, it all makes sense, and a surprise ending enlightens and delights us. And yet with such scanty knowledge as that, people presume to judge God and his play in its entirety. Speaking of a play, life is like an audition. We are on the stage being watched by the more mature and wiser heads of the cosmos. They want to see how we'll act, how we deal with the issues confronting us in mortality, and if we can maintain our integrity and bring to their attention qualities that will fit us for a productive, challenging, and growth-filled and rewarding life as the eternities unfold. They're taking notes. These notes will be reviewed by us and them as we stand before them after our death to be positioned in the cosmos for the long haul. We won't be able to expect much of a future from them if we've been dishonest, greedy, selfish, violent, unwilling to learn, and so forth. Eternity is a long time. I've been in a dead-end, boring career for me, driving a truck for 20-plus years. Imagine the feelings if that was all the future I could look forward to forever. Which would be better? The burning fires of hell, which, by the way, is allegory, it's not literally true, as the fundamentalist imagined it, or the feeling that life has come to a dead end, and we can expect no better future than that for which we've proven ourselves worthy in our mortal audition. Life is a rose. Roses consist of blossoms and thorns. The blossoms are fragrant, have deep, rich color. The petals are soft and velvety. I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon, city of roses. Stop and smell the roses, say I. But roses also have thorns. You can't have one without the other. The thorns can be nasty, and if you're not aware, they can give you a fairly good gash. We can't separate them from the rose. They are part of it, and we have to be careful. Should we, therefore, avoid roses? No, of course not. Just handle with care is all. No one in their right mind would forego the sensory pleasures roses have to offer because of a fear of thorns. People who notice only the thorns, pessimists, aren't taking in the whole picture. People who notice only the bloom are likewise functioning with only half the truth. Pollyannas, we have to see both blossom and thorns and handle accordingly. That is a major skill to develop. It's a skill relevant to finding happiness in marriage. I guarantee your partner will have his or her thorns, along with the blossom that attracts you to them. In some cases, the thorns get to be too much and the marriage must be dissolved. But I bet in most divorces, the thorns got way more weight in the equation than they should have, and an honest appreciation of the other partner's blossom might have prevented an emotional disaster, especially for the children. Example, when I first got married, I realized Debbie, my wife, had as one of her characteristics loyalty. She was loyal to me. That's the blossom. She was also loyal to her family. Okay, I learned early on that I needed to rein in my tendency to make snarky remarks. I might mean them just for fun. She'd take them seriously. So, okay, Hazel, don't mess with her family. But she was also loyal to her employer, the phone company, an entity I hate with a purple passion. Many times I had to bite my tongue to avoid the unnecessary conflict that would arise if I spoke my mind about Ma Bell. Thorns on this rose, be careful. It wasn't a hill I felt that it was necessary I should die on. Nor is this to say thorns are evil and blossoms are good. One man's thorns may be another person's blossom. Take vegetarianism. If I needed to marry again and the woman I was dating turned out to be vegan, I'd probably quit dating her. Too much of life revolves around having meals together and having a constant argument over who's eating what would be more fractionalization than I would want to deal with. But she might well find a man who is also vegan, and they could make a happy life together. As a rather obscure poet has put it in haiku form, see, life is a rose, thorns, blossoms, and fragrance mixed, inseparable. Lee Hazel, Haiku, Life Lessons in 17 Syllables, unpublished as of March 2022. And thus is the integrity of this work compromised. It's becoming a toy. I'm using it as a vehicle to promote my poetry. Jordan Peterson opposite to sum up, chaos and order are fundamental elements because every lived situation, even every conceivable lived situation, is made up of both. Page 44. Life is yin and yang. Again, opposites, but not good versus evil. If you know what the yin and yang symbol looks like, you'll notice they are equally balanced, each tailing off into the other, and each has a round spot of the other in its configuration. We can never truly separate ourselves from that which we think of as other. And truth be known, we probably have more in common with them than we know. Besides, we're all in this one great circle of life together anyway, and there's no escaping to the outside. And that one great circle containing both yin and yang, is it not God's creation? The one big whole into which all the works of God can be combined? The same God who puts thorns on roses also puts opposites to each of his children and commands that we be one. That is not to say one with evil, but rather one with all which isn't evil, even if it is different from us. The 50s philosopher Alan Watts tried to organize the entire universe into prickles and goo. I remember hearing this on a recorded book, so sorry, no chapter and verse nor book title. Ambitious to say the least. Again, not good and evil. Just roses and thorns, or yin and yang, or as he termed it, prickles and goo. He started out, German army, prickles. Now, he was just a few years past World War II, so that group is probably still on most people's minds. Goo, the patterns of seafoam as it washed up on the shore. Clouds. But after a while, he came to the conclusion that no matter how prickly something might be, there was still a bit of goo in it. And no matter how gooey something might be, there were elements of prickles that couldn't be denied. So he came to the conclusion that life is prickly goo and gooey prickles. You can see, I'm sure, the similarities to yin and yang here. And again, they can't be separated. You have to take them as a whole package. Baby in bathwater. Now here possibly is where an element of good versus evil may creep in. I'm sure you've heard the old folks saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are some cases where bathwater might be evil. In dining out, I order from the menu, but I forego the wine. Evil, at least as far as Mormon codes go. But I'm not going to say it's evil for everyone, though for an alcoholic it may be. Sometimes in our lives we are faced with a package of qualities that may contain bathwater, which can be thrown out. It's not like roses and thorns, where the thorns are inseparable from the rose. As life unfolds for us, we have to discern between that which is rose and must be accepted whole for what it is, and that which is baby in bathwater and might be susceptible to some tinkering for the better on our part by throwing out the bathwater. Example, as I read the latest editions of one of the magazines I subscribe to, I ignore the great majority of the ads. They aren't evil. They're just bathwater. Voting for a politician falls into this category. There may be some babies in his platform. There most likely is also bathwater. If the babies outnumber the bathwater, then he might be worth voting for, and we just cross our fingers on the bathwater and hope he never gets around to implementing them. In today's extremist political climate, many people find a sprinkling of bathwater and totally refuse to vote for what would otherwise be a viable politician. Life is a school. In a classroom of, say, 30 children, the teacher asks a question. 10 to 15 eager young hands shoot up. The teacher calls on one who gives the right answer, and the lesson moves on. What of the other kids who raised their hands? How many also had the right answer, perhaps better answer, or, of course, a wrong answer? We see people who are successful, actors, writers, businessmen, athletes. They are life's winners. Were they the only ones who had the right answer? Or is it possible that life can only call on one person at a time, and those with equally good or even better answers just didn't have the luck to get called on? Not everyone who wants to be a Hollywood actor or actress will have that shot. Probably for every Tom Cruise, there are 99 male actors washing dishes and cars who could do his roles just as well. Same with businessmen, artists, and such like. I think athletes are different for the most part. True athletic ability will usually come forth. For every book published, I hear there are approximately 95 to 100 rejected by the editors, the famous slush pile. I've contributed 16 books to that oozing heap. Does that mean none of those other books were worthy? Or was it just the luck of the draw? Or in many cases, someone knowing someone else? Certainly, at least some were worthy of publication and would have been successful. Those of us who aren't called on just have to accept the crapshoot that life is and realize luck wasn't with us this time around, and maybe we have to choose another path, such as driving a truck, if for no other reason than basic survival. I say this with me in mind, of course. This not being chosen isn't always a reflection on our talents and intelligence. It's just the luck of the draw. The only true assessment of our abilities and character is whether we keep trying or not. My dad kept painting even when it was obvious he'd never be a popular artist and make any sales. I keep writing even when my only hope of readers and success is in my posterity. Those of us not chosen need to dial back our envy and self-pity and realize that's just the way life is, and it's not an eternal reflection on our personal worth and talents. It's hard to not give in to feelings of failure and loser in these circumstances. I've had to fight that over the decades, 40 years nearly. One assumes in the eternities all talents will be recognized, developed, and used, since the cosmos isn't tied into the debilitating market economy, and it's big enough that there's a productive and satisfying place for everyone who strives to develop themselves so they have something to contribute to the whole. Those chosen need to realize that there are many who are just as talented, smart, and capable as them, but just weren't as lucky. Can we call this luck? I do believe in luck in this context, though it's more possible that God has a plan for each of us, and being chosen is just as much a part of his plan for one as not being chosen in the above context of temporal success is a part of his plan for the majority of his children. Last analogy, life is like a 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. Many worry about whether their individuality will be lost in becoming one with God. I don't think so. In a jigsaw puzzle, each piece is an individual. It has its own shape and colors. No other piece is like it. Yet it must fit in with all the others to make a complete picture. We are like that, individuals. Yet we fit in with all the others for a whole picture. Our individuality is neither lost nor compromised. If we don't fit in, no matter how complete the rest of the puzzle is, the eye is automatically drawn to that one blank spot, and the puzzle assembler goes looking for that missing piece. In thinking and dealing with others, especially those who I might not particularly like, I always have to remind myself they are a piece of the puzzle too, and have their place. I just hope it isn't next to me. Life is, always has been, and always will be, a working combination of opposites. In the case of the puzzle pieces, individuality and fitting in with the group. Don't let a too strong focus on one aspect or the other take you out of the puzzle, take you away from making the most of what is your life in connection with others. And one last look at life, just to indulge my love for doggerel. Of course, you know, doggerel is short and pithy, satirical, humorous poetry. This poem from Walter Savage Landor, 1775 to 1864. Alas, how soon the hours are over, counted us out to play the lover. And how much narrower is the stage allotted us to play the sage. But when we play the fool, how wide the theater expands, beside how long the audience sits before us. How many prompters! What a chorus! And thus we conclude this fourth podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Death Birth, Chapter 2, and we'll deal with how we look at death. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in. And special thanks to Craig Whitmore, my technical guy.